is the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, December 1st, World AIDS Day 2005. Still to this date, five people die of AIDS every minute. In the news today, PGE stole taxpayers' money, not Enron. Actually, Enron did some stealing too. New documents have been released that show Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito to be a long-time opponent of abortion. And polls coming out of Iraq show that a significant number of voters would like to see Saddam Hussein run for election. Portland area weather. Cloudy, rain, temperatures in the low 40s. There's still a chance of snow at higher altitude, but the snow warning issued earlier has been lifted. Tonight, rain, chance of snow flurries, temperatures in the mid-30s.
A report by the City of Portland concluded that Portland General Electric has overcharged ratepayers by nearly $1 billion since it was purchased by energy giant Enron. City Commissioner Randy Leonard, who asked for the review, says he will draft letters to the city attorney and the Multnomah County District Attorney asking for an investigation. In addition to the overcharges, Leonard said PGE has repeatedly said it sent all of the state and federal taxes it collected to Enron. Now, the city has learned it kept nearly $100 million. Leonard says PGE officials lied. His comments came after the Willamette Week reported yesterday that it had documents indicating that PGE tax strategy was a deliberate effort to boost revenue and executive bonuses.
It looks like the heavy snow people were worried about today in the Portland-Vancouver area won't be happening. The National Weather Service has cancelled a winter storm warning for those areas. This includes the cities of Hillsborough, Portland, Oregon City, Gresham, Vancouver, and Battleground, Washington. But a snow advisory is in effect until noon today, mainly above 1,000 feet. Snow accumulations of up to 2 inches are possible this morning between 500 to 1,000 feet of elevation. A snow advisory means to be prepared for snow, covered roads, and limited visibilities. This winter storm warning has also been cancelled for the central Willamette Valley, also including the cities of Salem, McMinnville, and Dallas.
This weekend, a group of local Christians, as well as activists, will meet to talk about building gay-positive congregations. The event is called Out Front Oregon, Building Welcoming and Affirming Communities, and includes speakers from Basic Rights Oregon, as well as a variety of local churches. Participants will include scholars discussing how gays and lesbians are depicted in biblical text, and how these texts relate to the modern day. KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi spoke with Reverend Tara Wilkins, Out Front, Oregon.
What kind of response have you received so far from other congregations in putting this event together?
People are very excited. Congregations that are wrestling with issues of inclusivity and how to be positive to all people, but especially to gay, lesbian, bi, trans people, want tools to help their congregations function in a more affirming way.
Great. Do you feel that you're preaching to the converted, or are you reaching out to a broader group?
I would say that all of the participants and are people who are interested in being affirming, but maybe their congregation isn't quite there yet, rather than people that are way on the other side who are very condemning. So there's a real yearning for information and for tools from the people that are coming who want to take those steps between being open and being affirming.
Can you tell us about the event? Who will be speaking?
Rebecca Castle from Basic Rights Oregon and I are leading a workshop called Faith into Action, which gives congregations tools to be good advocates, including media training and how to get congregations involved in speaking out politically. Dr. Marianne Tolbert from the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies in Berkeley will be doing a workshop on reading the Bible ethically in the 21st century. And then there'll be a third workshop that helps congregations deal with people who are coming from a purely emotional place. The subtitle of that one is called How to Respond to I Don't Care What You Say, It's Just Wrong. And Dr. David Koontz, who's a gay priest and family counselor is going to be leading us in that. There'll also be worship, mm-hmm. and Reverend Glenna Shepherd from Metropolitan Community Church will lead the closing plenary, you know, as we all ponder what next.
That was KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi.
The Oregon Health News this month released a detailed financial report on Oregon's hospitals. They found that statewide hospitals are making more money than ever and that executive incomes are overtaking physicians' salaries. But at the same time, hospital quality is slipping. KBOO's Brian Pritchett spoke with Dave Rosenfeld of Oregon Health News.
First, tell us about the study.
Our report looks at the financial statements of Oregon hospitals and basically asks the question of how much money are they making. We analyzed 57 hospitals that reported their earnings separately to the Office of Health Policy and Research. And we did this because, you know, we're at a time when most people would agree that healthcare costs are rising out of control and more people are uninsured. There are now about 600,000 people without health insurance in Oregon, and we know that hospitals drive about a third of healthcare costs. So we wanted to find out if hospitals were suffering as much as everyone who has to pay for healthcare. And what we found is that they really aren't. And while hospitals are big business, the small rural facilities really aren't sharing in that wealth.
What would you consider to be the most significant finding?
Well, the bottom line of the report is that Oregon hospitals earned a total of $342.6 million in net income in 2004. We found that operating margins have increased by a few percentage points from 1999 to 2004, and we found that operating income has gone up by 56%. Like I said, the financial success hasn't been shared by the rural hospitals. The Type A hospitals, the smallest and most rural facilities, recorded operating deficits for 5 out of the 6 years we analyzed. Our past reports have been pretty well known for publishing the top salaries of hospital employees, and this time around we found that executive salaries are overtaking those of physicians more than ever before. We compiled a top 10 list of salary earners in hospitals throughout the state and found that only 3 of those on the top 10 were doctors. The highest paid employee in 2003 was the president of Legacy Health System, Robert Polari, who earned more than $2.2 million, and that's total compensation, including some deferred compensation. And as far as hospital systems, Providence Health System was by far the winner. They made $104 million in 2004, and that's tax-free money. We have to remember hospitals are considered non-profit. They do not pay taxes. Only 2 Oregon hospitals are profit. And, you know, they have a non-profit status because they provide some form of charity care. But when we looked at charity care, we found that it's very difficult to measure because hospitals, there really isn't a standard for measuring charity care.
But finally, Dave, what can Oregon consumers do about these issues?
Well, there really isn't much that people can do at this point. I mean, there isn't the type of transparent information out there that people can use to make decisions based on cost and quality. You know, a lot of health plans don't offer those choices, but, you know, there's a lot of people that are working on this issue and trying to make that happen. Also about the report, if anyone would like to order a copy or subscribe to our newsletter, our website address is www.healthforum.org.
That was KBOO's Brian Pritchett.
Consumer-driven health care plans provide employees with a set amount of money to pay for medical expenses, but companies are slow to adopt them. After the medical expense fund is exhausted, a deductible applies, and when it's met, a traditional plan kicks in. These plans have high deductibles, which make them cheaper for employers. But the plans haven't gained traction. They do seem to save money, and some big employers have embraced them. When first introduced, the plans were heralded as an antidote for skyrocketing health costs when they arrived on the scene a few years ago. There are 2 types of consumer-driven plans: health reimbursement accounts, or HRAs, and health service accounts, HSAs. One major difference is that in an HRA, the employer must fund the pool of money initially used for expenses. In an HSA, the money can come from either the employer, the employee, or some combination of the two. Individuals fund the pool with the pre-tax dollars.
An oily sheen spotted on the Willamette River early yesterday was traced to a diesel tank on the roof of the Safe Corporation building in downtown Salem. Salem Fire Department crews were called to the Safe building, and the staff discovered the overfilled tank. Safe was alerted to the problem, and a few employees complained about a bad odor in the building. No health problems were immediately reported. Safe officials blamed the leak on a malfunctioning pump that caused the smaller tank to overfill. Fuel ran into a rain gutter on the roof and was discharged into the city's stormwater system. The leak was confined inside the building to the 7th floor and was not expected to affect business operations today. Safe will be responsible for the cleanup costs, this according to the Salem Statesman Journal.
The war in Iraq and prices at the pump are renewing calls for reducing the United States' dependence on foreign oil. This week, Stanford University kicked off a lecture series titled The End of Oil, examining questions about the future, energy, and the environment. The California Report's Scott Schaefer talked with David Howell, a consulting professor at Stanford School of Earth Sciences and a participant in the lecture series.
David Howell helped create the lecture series. He says he's skeptical of politicians who call for weaning the United States away from oil.
Every politician, from as long as I can remember being a professional geologist, has talked about energy independence, and each year we become more dependent upon foreign oil. Energy is, you can think of it as the various sectors. We have transportation, which is largely oil and with some natural gas, and electricity, which is principally coal with nuclear and some natural gas as well. The idea of energy independence is a noble effort, but we need to be much more serious about it than we are at the present time.
We just don't have the technology currently, or the willpower, what?
I think it's a combination of several things. One is that the amount of energy that we need, and I put need in quotes, increases each year. So we need to become more efficient, energy intensive. We need to learn to conserve more. Each American burns equivalent to 25 barrels of oil per year. In Japan, it's 15 barrels of oil per year. In Europe, it's 15. So we need to somehow maintain our economy, our well-being, and our comforts, but in a more energy-intensive way.
And to what extent are renewable sources of energy, solar, wind, hydrogen, hybrid cars, to what extent are those the answer to getting to that point?
Well, I think there's a lot of optimism that maybe they will, in the out years, provide something. But at the moment, it's less than 0.5% of our total energy comes from solar and wind. Nuclear has been stable for the last 25 years at about 7%. I think that if we are going to be serious about that, we need to have much more R&D, much more technological development, and much more resolve on politicians and all of us as individuals to move towards alternative energies.
That was a California Report, Scott Schaefer.
Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito, during the Reagan administration, argued for a legal strategy of chipping away at the landmark Supreme Court ruling Roe v. Wade, referring to a high court decision to review two abortion-related cases. At the time, Alito asked, "What can be made of this opportunity to advance the goals of bringing about the eventual overruling, and in the meantime, of mitigating its effects?" The memo is among several hundred pages of documents dating from Alito's 1981 to 1987 tenure in the Justice Department. The documents were released on the day the Supreme Court heard arguments in an abortion case for the first time in 5 years. The argument before the justices yesterday concerned the validity of a New Hampshire law that requires a parent to be told before a daughter ends her pregnancy. It is roughly the type of case that Alito was writing about 2 decades ago when he urged the administration to seek small victories in its legal battle against abortion. While no ruling in the current case is expected for months, the case will provide the first indication of Chief Justice John Roberts' views on abortion cases. It is also possible at a last word from Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. She has been the swing vote in the past on rulings that upheld abortion rights, and Alito's nomination as her replacement has raised the stakes in his confirmation battle. Alito stepped carefully around his one-time membership in Concerned Alumni of Princeton, the conservative organization sparked controversy 2 decades ago by saying school officials had lowered admission standards to accept women and minority applicants.
Crips co-founder Stanley Tookie Williams moved one step closer to the death chamber yesterday. The California Supreme Court refused to reopen his case and halt the state's highest-profile execution in a quarter century. Attorneys for Williams, in a last-ditch legal move, petitioned the justices on November 11th, They are alleging shoddy forensic testing and other errors may have wrongly sent him to San Quentin State Prison. Williams is scheduled to die by a lethal injection on December 13th.
The Walgreen Company says it has put four Illinois pharmacists in the St. Louis area on unpaid leave for refusing to fill prescriptions for emergency contraception in violation of a state rule. The four cited religious or moral objections to filling the prescriptions for the morning after pill, a rule imposed by Governor Rod Blagojevich in April requires Illinois pharmacies that sell contraceptives approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to fill prescriptions for emergency birth control. Pharmacies that do not fill prescriptions for any type of contraception are not required to follow the rule. At least six other pharmacists have sued over the rule. They are claiming it forces them to violate their religious beliefs. Many of those lawsuits were filed by Americans United for Life. The licenses of both a pharmacy and that store's chief pharmacist could be revoked if they don't comply with the Illinois rule. Walgreen policy says pharmacists can refuse to fill prescriptions to which they are morally opposed, except where state law prohibits, but they must take steps to have the prescriptions filled by another pharmacist or store. It was not clear whether other large pharmacy chains had taken similar action.
The U.S. government is being taken to court for a Border Patrol killing that took place several years ago. We get more from FSRN's Otto Bogado.
Over 3.5 years ago, 18-year-old Bennett Patricio was killed by a Border Patrol officer driving a vehicle on the Tohono O'odham Reservation's Highway 20 near Tucson. U.S. Border Patrol agent Cody Roos struck Bennett Patricio and dragged his body at least 50 feet before stopping. When the agent called in to report the incident, he simply claimed there was a body on the side of the road and did not admit that he struck Bennett Patricio until later in the investigation. Patricio's mother, Angelita Ramon, was told by police officers that her son was killed. She then waited days, weeks, and months to hear an apology for her son's death from the Border Patrol, but never got one. A trial is now underway in a U.S. district court charging the U.S. government with responsibility for Patricio's death. Wake Up Call's Deepa Fernandez spoke with Bennett Patricio's mother, Angelita Ramon, about the trial.
From the beginning, when I found out that my son had died, I had waited for a week. I had waited for them to come and tell me how sorry they were. And I was willing to accept that because I didn't know what happened. But then when they went and they threatened his father that if he was to say anything to anybody that he would be next. And they have never, never apologized, not any of them. The Border Patrol has made it very ugly down here. They have not even improved nothing. They've only made things worse.
Angelita Ramon, speaking with Wake Up Call's Deepa Fernandez about her son's death at the hands of the Border Patrol near Tucson, Arizona.
That's Otto Bogado of Free Speech Radio
News.
More
than 1,000 protesters assembled.
Today is World AIDS Day. Actions to promote awareness of the disease are happening around the world, with many in Asia. Dozens of HIV-infected women in eastern India acknowledge that they have AIDS. The women say they should not be shunned. Thousands marched in anti-AIDS rallies in northeast India. An estimated 5.1 million people are living with HIV in India, the most in any single country except South Africa. China, in its marking of World AIDS Day, began an educational campaign targeting millions of migrant workers today. Chinese Central Television showed condoms being passed out to workers at a Beijing construction site. In Jakarta, the head of UNAIDS criticized Indonesia's leaders for not taking a more active role in combating the disease. And Australia announced today it will spend $7.4 million over 5 years to help India fight the virus in the northeast region. Countries across Asia said more focus must be placed on educating young people if the world has any chance of getting a grip on the disease. An estimated 8.3 million people are living with HIV in Asia, with 1.1 million newly infected last year, according to a recent report from UNAIDS.
Iraqis have asked Saddam Hussein's defense team to mull the possibility of fielding Hussein as a candidate for future elections. Former Qatari Justice Minister Najib al-Nuami said Iraqis have asked the defense team to study the legal conditions to present Saddam Hussein as a candidate for elections, first as an MP, then as president. Nuami is among three foreign lawyers sworn in by the Iraqi court on Monday as members of Saddam's defense team. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark and Jordanian lawyer Issam Gowazi were the others. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who has joined Saddam Hussein's defense team, said on Tuesday he had no time to discuss legal issues or trial strategy at his first meeting with the Iraqi ex-president. When they met for the first time on Monday, Saddam said he was overjoyed to meet Clark and his companions. Clark, speaking on arrival in the Jordanian capital from Baghdad, said he expected to meet the toppled Iraqi leader again on Sunday to discuss defense strategy ahead of the next hearing on December 5th.
Talks between U.S. officers and Iraqi tribal leaders have been interrupted by mortar fire. Apparently nobody was hurt in the attack today in the western town of Ramadi. The U.S. military says a single rocket-propelled grenade was fired at an observation post. U.S. and Iraqi troops launched a new offensive yesterday near Ramadi. 2,000 American Marines, soldiers and sailors are being backed up by about 500 Iraqi troops. The mission is to clear out a region along the Euphrates River, said to be a safe area used by militants to make car bombs. And in Baghdad, Iraq's top human rights official has been sacked, reportedly by the prime minister. His ouster is linked to an investigation of alleged prisoner abuse and torture by Iraqi security police.
Shimon Peres, the veteran Israeli politician, left the Labour Party yesterday, according to the Times of London. Peres abandoned his political home of nearly six decades to campaign for Ariel Sharon's new Kadima party. Former Israeli Prime Minister Peres has held every major cabinet position. He resigned after his humiliating loss 3 weeks ago to Labour leader Amir Peretz in the race for party leader. He said that he was supporting Prime Minister Sharon as a person who had the best chance for restarting the peace process. Peres' defection was a coup for Ariel Sharon's new party, as a major political faction scrambled to snare supporters ahead of a parliamentary elections in March. Many Israelis respect Peres for his decades of service, but others view him warily as a dove and political opportunist.
Nations meeting at UN Environmental Conference in Montreal yesterday adopted rules for limiting emissions of greenhouse gases under the UN's Kyoto Protocol. This from Reuters. Kyoto obliges about 40 rich nations to curb their emissions of heat-trapping gases, mainly from burning fossil fuels in factories, cars, and power plants, by 2012. The rules include details of accounting for greenhouse gases, how to encourage investments in developing countries, rules for trade in greenhouse gas emissions, and other operational details. The Montreal meeting agreed to all but one of the 22 sections of the rules, but Saudi Arabia said it wanted rules on compliance to be approved by an amendment to be ratified by all nations. That process could take years. Saudi delegates argue that an amendment would give the deal more legal teeth, but environmentalists accused Riyadh of trying to bog down Kyoto. They say the move is driven by Saudi dislike of a scheme likely to force a shift away from oil and towards cleaner energies. Kyoto is a tiny step towards breaking a warming trend that most scientists say could cause more floods, storms, drive up sea levels, spread diseases, and push thousands of species to extinction.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair announced a major review of British nuclear energy policy yesterday. But his speech was overshadowed by a serious security breach when environmental campaigners infiltrated the venue. Two protesters from Greenpeace scaled the interior walls of the Confederation of British Industry Conference Center. They attached themselves to the ceiling, where they unfurled banners saying, "Nuclear, wrong answer," and threw stickers and paper onto the assembled crowd. Greenpeace representatives said the protesters would disrupt Blair's address by heckling and throwing missiles unless they were allowed to make a 10-minute speech to delegates beforehand. However, organizers rejected the ultimatum and after a 48-minute delay, moved the Prime Minister's speech to a smaller auditorium. Blair announced a full review of Britain's energy policy, including the option of increasing production of nuclear power to fill the looming energy gap. Blair is said to favor building a new generation of stations, but many politicians and environmental campaigners oppose the move. The debate is shaping up to become a ferocious one, and more protests are likely, this from the BBC.
The British government and senior police officers will be taken to court unless they provide evidence that they have investigated reports that the CIA torture flights have landed in Britain or used British airspace. This according to The Guardian. Shami Chakravarti, director of Liberty, the civil rights group, has written to Jack Straw, the British Foreign Secretary, and to chief constables. Chakravarti is giving them 2 weeks to disclose what they know about the flights and demand assurances from the US that they will stop. If they refuse to show they have investigated the allegations, Liberty will take them to court in 14 days to demand a judicial review. It is illegal under British and international law and under European and UN human rights conventions to be complicit in torture. A 26-strong fleet run by the CIA has used 19 British airports and RAF bases. The most used airport is Prestwick, near Glasgow. CIA aircraft have flown into and out from Prestwick more than 75 times. Ministers have sidestepped Parliament through questions about the flights. The Foreign Office has said only that the government is not aware of the use of their territory or airspace for purposes of extraordinary rendition. The answers leave open the questions of whether the government has turned a blind eye to flights whose purpose the US has not told them, and what records it holds of flights where passengers have not left the aircraft.
A splinter rebel group clashed with African Union monitors in Sudan's Darfur region yesterday. 5 soldiers were wounded. This as the 2 main rebel groups held peace talks with the Sudanese government in Nigeria yesterday. It was the latest in a series of clashes involving the National Movement for Reform and Development, or NMRD. The NMRD is a breakaway group demanding a seat at the Abuja talks. Presently, only the 2 principal rebel groups are represented. The violence has led some observers to say any deal reached at Abuja will not translate into peace on the ground. Talks to end the conflict opened in Abuja, and negotiations on power sharing began yesterday afternoon.
In Brazil, federal police are evicting settlers and loggers from an Amazon area experts believe is home to one of the world's most isolated Indian tribes. Police have arrested 27 people accused of illegal land appropriation and possible genocide in a removal operation involving 120 officers in Mato Grosso state. Government anthropologists first detected traces of the tribe in 1998. In 2001, the Bureau issued a decree banning outsiders from about 410,000 acres of rainforest to allow anthropologists to contact the tribe and demarcate a reservation. The tribe doesn't have a name, although it has been referred to as the Rio Pardo tribe after a nearby river. Little is known about the group except that it has only up to 15 members who live by hunting animals and gathering natural growing fruits and vegetables. The Brazilian Bureau discovered that outsiders were trying to chase the Indians away and destroy signs of their presence to keep the area from being declared a reservation.
This has been the KABU Morning News for Thursday, December 1st, 2005. Chris Andre, Kathleen Stevenson, and Brian Smith edited the news. KABU's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape, and KABU's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is AM News and Public Affairs Director, and it's she who's on the board right now. I'm Brian Smith.
Good.
We welcome your participation in this program. To volunteer, you can call us at 503-231-8032, reach us by email at www.kabu.org, or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Check out the new, improved website at kabu.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 100.7 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR, and be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of solid news on the KBOO Evening News. Portland area weather today, cloudy, rainy, temperatures in the low 40s. And there's still a chance of snow at higher altitudes, but the snow warning issued earlier has been lifted. Tonight, rain, chance of snow flurries, and temperatures in the mid-30s. Coming up this morning on KBOO, at 7:30, Alan Graff and Joanne Bowman host Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. At 9, it's Queer, Queer World with Jack. At 9:30, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 10, Lisa Loving interviews R.V. Branham of the Gobshite Quarterly. We'll discuss the upcoming issue. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard's guest is Stephanie Snyder, curator of the Cooley Gallery at Reed College. They'll discuss the gallery's current show featuring the work of British mixed media and performance artist Mona Hatun. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And tune in tonight for the KBOO Evening News with public testimony on protecting Mount Hood by Oregon Congressional Representative Earl Blumenauer and Greg Walden. The Evening News will also discuss how the Portland Anti-Military Recruitment Coalition focuses on Franklin High School. Thanks for joining us.